Tynwald's Environment and Infrastructure Committee held an evidence session with officers from the MUA last week, and there were several revelations which I hope are of interest to you. On today's programme, you'll hear some edited highlights from the hearing.
I'm Rob Mercer, MLC, Chair of this committee, and with me are Chris Thomas, MHK, and Diane Kelsey, MLC. And today we are meeting with representatives of the Manx Utilities Authority.
Phil King, Chief Executive since Manx Utilities formation in 2014, and then held a number of roles for Manx Electricity before that.
Hello, I'm Adrian Dobbins. I'm one of the Executive Directors at Manx Utilities. I'm responsible for our power system. I've been an Executive Director since 2005, as you know, within the MEA and then the MUA.
Hi, I'm Simon Clegg. I'm the Finance Director and I've been in post 10 years.
We last took oral evidence from the MUA in February 2023. Could you give us just an overview of the key developments that have taken place since then? And you know, please include what you would see as your biggest accomplishments in that time.
So I think when we saw you in 2023, that was at the time of just after the energy crisis. That was a challenging time for us, for the whole island really. We were at the time faced with a difficult situation in terms of energy pricing. Gas prices, wholesale gas prices, had gone through the roof, something we'd never seen before in the previous 10 years. Although we were responsibly and heavily hedged, well out even on the unhedged portion, the prices we were faced with were quite extraordinary. So we approached the council ministers as a key stakeholder and advised that we were going to have to do something with the price. We were directed at the time that wasn't to be the case in the public interest, so our prices were frozen. And as a result of that, we had quite strong financial resilience at the time, but we had to dive into our reserves. I think we took 25 million out of our reserves. We, at the time, the whole industry was in turmoil. I think around 30 supply companies in the UK ceased trading. They were either undercapitalized or not hedged. We were in that position. We had financial resilience. Having said that, we couldn't do that again. So a big part of the last 2 years has been trying to build up that financial resilience again, maintain service standards and help our customers with the standards of supply that we offer, and working closely with our customers who were in similar situations. So that's been a really big challenge for us over the last 2 years. Meanwhile, obviously, we've been faced with a new world in terms of an investment phase. So we've been doing a lot of work in terms of surveys and feasibility studies to assess the current status, which has changed again since 2023, and work out an optimum investment pathway for Manx Utilities going forward to address climate change, but at the same time maintain resilient supplies, secure supplies in an affordable way. So that's been the real big challenge for us over the last couple of years.
I wanted to ask about that £25 million loss from the energy crisis, from the price crisis. You know, plain looking at the 22-23 financial year would suggest that your overall reserves fell by more than £40 million, yeah, and your bond repayment fund fell by more than £20 million. Yeah. So just so we can put this, you know, to bed once and for all, yeah, you know, how much did the direction from council ministers cost in terms of the overall financial reserves, in terms of the gas price and not passing it on to electricity consumers? What was it, £25 million that you led, or was it, or is it the £60 million, which looks like from the straight looking at the annual reports?
For accurate information, may I pass that over to you, Simon?
Yeah. Okay. So I would say it's closer to the £25 million than the £60 million. Mm-hmm. At the time we got the direction from council, there was a motion which went through Tynwald for a £26 million loan. The value of that loan was based on the expected loss we would incur from that price freeze at that time. And as you say, that year's financial statements had a loss of £23 million, £20 to £25 million, something like that, off the top of my head. So that was the impact of that decision washing through. As you say, our reserves dropped. The bond repayment fund value dropped because we took £25 million out of it across, I think it was across three transactions, to support our cash position. Because obviously we were paying significantly more for the energy than we'd budgeted for and had allowed for on our income.
So I think it's not really fair to keep pressing on this, but perhaps it would be helpful to give us a written submission so we can use our report, any report we do, to put that issue to bed once and for all, exactly how that all works through.
Okay.
And the other one I was just going to ask is, it's good news that the bond repayment fund is now going up. But I couldn't help but notice in the last annual report I've got access to, because obviously one's about to come out, the Consolidated Loans Fund borrowing went up at the same time as the bond repayment fund went up. So I'm thinking, you know, it'd be important to know whether or not more money is just being borrowed to put into the bond repayment fund.
So money is not being borrowed to put into the bond repayment fund. The reason the bond repayment fund is going up, firstly, is because the contributions we make into that fund have significantly increased. So the target value or target figure for contribution this year was £15.5 million, which we made, I think, in July. So we've gone from a few years ago putting £1.5 million a year into that fund to putting £12.5 million, as I say, now up to £15.5 million. I think that number is due to rise to £18.5 million. Okay. And in terms of the borrowings going up, that's more to do with some of our asset investments coming through. So one of the big things we're doing at the moment is investing in the water network. And we've gone from low millions to, I think we're targeting about £6.5 million a year to replace aging water mains, and then we've obviously got other things like wastewater treatment works coming.
Just looking forward to the sort of next 2 to 5 years, you know, what are the main priorities looking in that kind of timescale?
So the main priorities are to continue providing a high standard of service to our customers. So the business as usual, what we fundamentally do for the Isle of Man, that must be delivered uncompromised. The big changes over the coming years are a change to investment profile. So we're coming to or approaching the end of one big investment phase, and we need to work out exactly what we're going to be doing over the next sort of 10 to 20 years to address all the climate change issues, aging infrastructure, changes in legislation, all those issues. If we break it down into roughly three areas, obviously the energy transition is big. That's a big new challenge for us. We need to complete the regional sewerage treatment strategy. We're nearly at the end of that. So we'll do that in the next few years. And then, as our FD has just mentioned, we need to maintain a resilient water supply system, monitoring leakage levels. I think that at the moment, the 1,000 kilometres plus of water pipes, the average age is around 60 years. Just to stand still, we need to replace about 10 kilometres or £6 million worth a year. I think it's that sort of order. So again, that's just is really over the next 2 to 5 years, as you've asked, that's going to be a key focus point for water.
Yeah, that investment profile you mentioned there, is that related to the MUA's medium term financial plan? Has that had much of a change since we last spoke about it?
It's been refined. So what we do is we have a kind of strategic session with the board and the executive that looks forward probably 20 or beyond years at really big things, water treatment plants, things like that. and then so we can make provision of things that we know we're going to have to do sometime in the future. But we really close down on the front 5 years and fine-tune that. So what I would say is that since we last reported to you, we will have closed down on almost a project-by-project basis exactly what we'll be doing in those front years.
We'll just follow up on that then, because obviously financial plans, you know, not formally submitted by departments and so on. So exactly which document have you just referred us to, just so we know?
The pink book.
Certainly the pink book.
Our long-term engineering plan would be the document internally that we use to plan through to, you know, the next 25 years.
And I think it is different for statutory boards compared to departments, but this year we had a different way around because we have such close attention paid.
Thank you for clarifying. Yes, so there's two key documents we do with the board internally. One is we have a long-term investment plan, which is engineering-based. It's obviously a capital-intensive industry. And then that feeds through to the second key document, which is the long-term financial plan. Okay. And then aspects of that get taken out and submitted in appropriate format to the Treasury's pink book.
Then that's a chair difference. I think we're looking for the submission you made to Treasury, ideally.
Okay, that's great. Lovely. All right, thank you. Okay.
Mr. Thomas is going to take the next section, which is the topic is energy independence.
Okay.
The first question was, how resilient is the island's energy system to shocks, and are there any particular risks that threaten our energy security?
Okay, so just breaking that down a little bit, obviously price is a big thing, so price shocks, and that's what we've seen. I think we touched on that before. Mm-hmm. We use a range of strategies to forward buy and introduce certainty into pricing for ourselves and for customers. Mm-hmm. So that policy that hedging strategy has been refined over recent years as the market volatility has changed. So independence from volatile pricing, we've got covered to a large degree. Mm-hmm. In terms of physical security, what we have at the moment, and we've had for a long time, is basically three asset classes or three different types of generation or power production that can meet the island's demand. So without any, well, pretty much we can meet the island demand on one of them. So we've got those extra layers of security. So those comprise the subsea cable, the CCGT plant, which is gas-fired, but it's actually dual-fueled. It can switch to oil as a backup. And thirdly, we have an obsolete diesel fleet, which has been very well maintained. It still works well as a third layer, really. And that's still available. We still have the skills to run it, and it's there for extra security. So that's pretty strong still. So we lose any one of those, and we test things all the time, so obviously we'll do maintenance on each one of those, so we'll make sure that the others provide the supply security.
Ms. Kelsey?
Yeah, it was just linking to the diesel side.
Yeah.
How long, if that was the only one, how long would we last for? But obviously other things might change, but
indeed,
how long could we run for?
Okay.
What would be your estimation, either from the equipment or from the availability of the input fuel?
So if you're talking specifically about the diesel engines, they're still all available to us. And if you mean how long could we run if we had nothing else available to us, with fuel stocks would be about 2 weeks, you know, in during the winter, probably longer during the summer.
That's right. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, just on a, it's an engineering question, is how much longer do you think those diesels can be maintained for?
Well, they've been a really, really strong asset for us. They're still available to us. They provide a very important service to us, in something we call black start. So if ever the island did ever go have a complete island blackout, we would use those engines to start. They've been obsolete for a while in terms of the technology. Obviously, new technology has moved on, but they can still run on the fuel we use today, and they can run in the future on clean fuels. So the issue probably would be how available are spare components for them? Are they supported by industry? But at the moment, we're seeing them being available well into the next decade.
So do I understand then that the only two aspects of the resilience that you're concerned about are price and physical security of the generating assets, or is there other things in the energy system that's susceptible?
In terms of independence, that within the industry, I think with what's happened since the energy crisis and the geopolitical position, there's a complete new way of looking at it now.
Mm-hmm.
And increasing the amount of homegrown, home-consumed energy is seen as a very positive move if you are to increase your resilience and your independence from external physical shocks. So that is very clear in the government's energy strategy, and I think that's about to be represented to Tynwald sometime soon. And that's a basic core principle, not just for the Isle of Man, but I think for many countries in Europe, is that there is an aspiration to increase, make use of your own abundant natural resources if you can, of which the Isle of Man has as many. So that's another aspect.
Mm-hmm. You called it government's energy strategy, so I've just changed the first part of my next question. So government's energy strategy identifies investment in onshore renewables as a way to reduce reliance on imported energy, just as you suggested, with the potential for an additional 25% to 33% of annual demand to be met from island sources, while continuing to use the interconnector for the remainder. From your perspective, what is required to deliver this level of additional on-island generation?
But there's a number of facets, isn't there, to that question? Mm-hmm. So obviously funding is one, because we obviously need to prepare and properly prepare business cases to make sure that we can deliver on the things that we propose.
Yeah.
Proper evaluation of all of those solutions. I'm just trying to think just remind me of the question again.
Well, the final question is, what is required to deliver 25 to 33% of annual demand from island sources?
Yeah, so skills, and we need strong service in terms of the manufacturers. We need those to have components available to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to make sure that all of our solutions actually knit together very, very well, so that we end up with a resilient system as we have today.
Okay. Well, because we haven't seen the energy strategy, but it is due for debate in November, so we should be seeing it soon. But you feel that the energy strategy that we'll see in Tynwald in November will be sufficient for us to have a good idea of all of that sort of material, do you?
I think it will definitely provide more clarity on the current situation and a favoured pathway.
Yeah.
I was actually referring to the last publication, which I think was probably about a year ago.
Last November, yeah.
Yes, and I think within that there are a number of core principles, and I just recall one of them being making optimum use of our abundant on-island renewables.
Okay, well, to be completely clear then, last year's the main thing that I got from it was, next year would be much better because it would have been costed and there would have been funding alternatives and there would have been evaluation of alternatives. So I ask the question again, do you believe, because you at one point when you first started talking, you talked about the optimum investment pathway, that they were your words, optimum investment pathway. Will we see in the November 2025 energy strategy from the government MUA's view of the optimum investment strategy for energy independence and energy security?
I think what you'll see is a statement on the current situation and the previous plan, the assumptions that were made to devise a pathway then, they've changed. So with the current situation, there are a number of options available to us to achieve that outcome.
Yep.
And I think you will see that, and perhaps a hint at the favoured pathway, but we're at the precipice of a major investment programme it is really important for the Isle of Man that that is based on currency information. And okay. once we press the button on that investment profile and start spending real money, yeah. It's the best pathway that we can devise. Yeah. At the same time, you know, we need to meet these targets that have been set. But obviously, this is a 2050 target for the whole energy sector. Electricity only represents 25% of it. So can we keep options open for the future to enable us to capitalise on new technologies that are emerging or will emerge and they will become commercialised? You know, so when I say the optimum, if you look at the front end, yeah. once you've set a target, you have to invest in technologies that you know are going to work, that are proven to meet that target. But if you've got a much more distant target, you can take a more open-minded view yeah. as to when you choose to capitalise on a particular technology.
And it's all very complicated, and we've only got a limited amount of time today, and I think the Chair just agreed that once we have more of a feel for what's in the energy strategy, it would probably be good to have a separate session, another additional session about just this, to test some of the things, if that's okay. I think just one thing to establish, I think there's been a clear statement from the Treasury Minister that the onshore wind farm isn't as yet funded, you know, decisions have got to be made. But I hear in places that you've gone quite a long way along a financial lease arrangement for, because obviously you've got to get in supply lines. So it would be very helpful, you know, because there's obviously lots of misinformation in this space. It'd be quite good to hear from the MUA that the Treasury Minister is right. Tim Wood will be involved in making the decision about it.
Absolutely. I think all we've done now is really done some surveys to help us with an environmental impact assessment to enable us to make a plan application. There was, if we wanted to do it particularly quickly, mm-hmm. Then you would have to make financial commitments up front and book manufacturing capacity and make commitments. None of that's happened. All that financial risk has come out. So I can categorically say that we've not made any of those commitments, and the process we will follow at the insistence of our own board and executive will be, and we have to follow financial regulations. Major Projects Board of Treasury are looking at this in detail. Treasury will look at it, Energy Policy Board, Council Ministers, and it will ultimately end up with Tim Wald.
Okay, thank you very much. So the next question I've got is, in your view, would total energy independence be either desirable or achievable? You know, and you sort of hinted at that. So it sounds like to date you've given us the answer. You do think it's desirable, but to put the counter argument, you know, you have an interconnector into the northwest of England, you have a gas supply from the UK, so we haven't had total independence in the past, and, you know, 85,000 makes us equivalent to a small Lancashire town. Not each Lancashire town needs to be energy independent. So I'll repeat the question, is total energy independence desirable or achievable?
If it can be achieved economically and securely, then would that be a great target, wouldn't it, that total independence? But this is a long journey, as I said, so I think we've started the journey, and there are many more technologies that may be able to contribute that may become available in the future.
And then finally then from me, how is Manx Utilities feeding into the roadmap for the transformation of the island's power systems? Is it DEFA's roadmap, or is it MUA's roadmap, or is it a government's roadmap? And who's responsible for costing all the elements of that roadmap?
I think it's an amalgam of all of those things. I think it wouldn't be sensible, would it, for DEFA not to consult with us? And we have proposed a number of solutions which can achieve the 2030 targets. As you rightly point out, it's for them to actually present that case. What we've been doing is spending time evaluating the various options, coming up with levelised costs of energy for each of the solutions, discussing that with our colleagues in DEFA, and I think it's sensible to appraise all of the options open to us and make sure we're making the right investment at the right time.
So, you know, I've got my notes here, what the DEFA minister said when she was with us a few months ago about, you know, that same question. And so there's no big differences between you. You're working together. DEFA will submit it. Treasury, Tim Wald will fund it. And you feel as if your voice is very important in presenting options and evaluating options.
Absolutely. Okay. And I think there's good collaboration. So although we don't set policy, we input information so that it can be informed as possible, sensible policy decisions.
We'll move on now to the next topic, which is energy infrastructure. Mrs. Kelsey.
So I suppose really we talk about change, but actually is our existing energy infrastructure sustainable? And I know you've touched on that bit, but also what role will it play as we go through the transition?
I think it's important to make sure that we've spent a lot of money on our existing infrastructure, and it's important to look at it and see what its capabilities are and integrate it into whatever the new solutions are. I mean, ultimately, it might mean that the assets aren't used in exactly the same way, but we certainly see some value, as we've already mentioned, in the way the interconnector can provide security of supply, how our power stations will provide definitely resilient solutions going forward, and integration with new renewable technology is part of the process. We also think that as we get a high penetration of renewables onto our grid system, and remember this, it's a fairly small grid system, you actually need to be able to accommodate all of that renewable technology, be it what we've invested or what the private sector have invested. And part of that process that we believe needs to happen is some form of storage system, so stored energy, which will help, to use your phrase, protect us against shocks.
And because we didn't specifically talk about it, I would then go to say, so what are the plans for the Pullrose power station going forward?
The CCGT part of it.
Yeah, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I mean, the CCGT plant plays a hugely important role in the way we produce and supply electricity on the Isle of Man today. In the main, it's currently cheaper to run the power station when it's running in combined cycle mode than to import electricity. And it's important for us to maintain those assets so that they can deliver that benefit to the consumer right the way through to the end of the decade. As I say, beyond that point, with the current climate change targets, we might have to use that plant in a different way. But it is already capable of running on a liquid fuel, and the future fuel that the power station could use could be green HVO type fuel.
So do you have any decommissioning plans? I mean, obviously eventually it has to be, but do you have any if somebody said we need to decommission it, are there any decommissioning plans yet? Or from what you've said, it sounds like it's part of your future solution.
But yeah, I think it's important to note that when the power station was built in 2003, it had a sort of technical life probably of target technical life about 30 years, but we've been investing in the infrastructure within it all through that period of time. And the financial life was probably set to be the same, but beyond the financial life, the assets can still be used. So we haven't particularly set aside any targets to decommission the CCGT plant at this moment in time.
I'm just, that liquid fuel, I think now you've raised it, we need to ask something more about it. So is that the same as, Islands Energy Group could stop taking gas through your pipeline and just bring it in by boat to their things, or is it a different type of liquid fuel? What is it exactly? Now you've mentioned it, I think we probably should know.
I referenced something called HVO, which is hydrogenated vegetable oil. Effectively, it's a vegetable produced version of diesel. Okay. So that's why we know that our diesel engines and our CCGT plant can run on that type of fuel.
Okay.
We probably use it as a sort of resilient backup in that mode, but not as a continuous source of fuel, because as we know today, the cost of that fuel is currently dearer than gas.
Just very specifically in the Pink Book, which you've referenced, I think there's about £10 million of investment in the CCGT before 2030. What's that doing? Is that keeping it going to 2030, or is it preparing for the 2030s, or what's it doing exactly?
In the main, it's keeping, it's what I said earlier, it's you have an efficiency of the power station which is deteriorated by running time. So over a period of time, we do need to, from time to time, replace the gas turbines. And it's so we just change the engines over. So from time to time, that investment is required to maintain the efficiency of the power station.
So by implication then, in the 2030s, if it's still being used, we'll also need £10 million plus inflation.
It would have less fired hours, basically, so the investment profile would change.
Okay, so it depends on use.
Yes.
Okay.
So when it starts. So obviously if it starts earlier, it's running longer and therefore it needs to be replaced.
Yeah, so I think what I've tried to suggest is that there's a potential for it to be running in a different mode and its fired hours will be different and therefore its investment profile will be different.
And you mentioned about our network and our electricity grid in particular. Is the capacity of the current electricity grid suitable for our renewable energy goals?
Yes. I mean, if you think about when the what we call the new power station, but effectively the CCGT plant was first commissioned, the actual peak demand on our island grid was somewhere over 90 megawatts. Today, it's somewhere nearer 70. So you've actually got a whole 20 megawatts of spare capacity in the grid system. What's nuanced and what's different about the future will be the insertion of renewable generation. And so we see already a fair degree of solar, what we call behind the meter, out into the grid system, and that changes the way the power system functions. So voltage profiles change and our ability to flow power to different parts of the grid system changes as a consequence. So future solutions might include modifying the way the we have to make our transformers function to properly allow power flows, so tap changing modifications and things like that.
Just for clarity, I think it might be useful for people listening. We hear this phrase behind the meter and in front of the meter, and I can never remember which way round that is. So I thought I might as well ask the question now while we've got you guys here. So from what you've just said, consumer solar, for example, would be behind the meter.
That's right.
Whereas grid scale solar that you would install,
yes,
and run
is in front of them.
Is in front. Okay.
Mine was a very simple one. So you've talked about very eloquently about 90 down to 70 and so on. When we were doing the bus trial, the electric buses are quite big users of electricity. When the minister recently started, we're meeting the Minister of Infrastructure soon, and she started talking about taking part in the Irish Sea electric ship use, so we'd have a big fat cable to put into our ships, and then we've got potentially medicinal cannabis farms, we've got even more successful data centres. Do you have an estimate of the extra uses that could be coming along with other parts of the transition in terms of electricity usage and what the impact would be? I mean, I didn't even mention cars then. And home heating.
So yeah, it's an interesting topic in terms of where's the strength of our grid, and clearly the strength of our grid is in Douglas. So if you're talking about reinforcing the capability of the sea terminal, it's not too far away from one of our primary nodes, which is Lord Street's substation, and it's where our interconnector comes ashore. In terms of what private sector might build, we obviously know about strategies in the south and the north, and we're in good collaboration with those people about what their aspirations are, and we're quite open to dialogue with them, and we talk to them about what is a sensible level of investment into the grid for them, as basically a seed process to what they might need to develop. So I don't think I could give you a formal megawatt number about what their needs are any more than I could tell you about how many new data centres might get built.
Well, I suppose what I'm saying is there a number that somebody's got for bus use of electricity with 70 electric vehicles, car use at certain percentages, air source heat pumps with a certain number? Are all those figures, are we going to see them all
I
in the energy
what
strategy?
Really is that when those aspirations come along, that we look at, where does it need to happen? Do we need to reinforce our grid for that specific connection?
Can I just add, I think that is the answer. I think included within our forecasts are a number of assumptions associated with transport change to electric vehicles. There are some assumptions on heating, so things like heat pumps and things like that going forward. Once we get a more definitive transport strategy with all its implications and heating strategies and building strategies, those numbers can be refined going forward. And as Adrian says, we are working close with the departments that have insight and knowledge as to the likely build and investment in key kind of industrial things perhaps, so that we can make sufficient allowance for those going forward in our plans.
So we touched on it earlier, Mr. Thomas picked up on the 10 million in the pink book, and it was very well explained, thanks Mr. Dobbins. But more broadly, are life cycle costs routinely factored into plans for new infrastructure and into the decisions of the viability of keeping existing structure, because that also needs to be maintained? I suppose where I'm coming from, because I'm engineer by background, I'm thinking life cycle costs. Just because you stop doing something, the other thing needs to be kept going and you're investing in it as well. So we're just really understanding how that strategy works within MUA.
It's interesting. I can give you an analogy which is not part of the energy infrastructure, but our regional sewage treatment strategy phase two, we took a look at a life cycle cost and did things like net present values for the whole of the 30-year proposed life of the the final solution. So as we mentioned, our long-term engineering plan that has a sort of 25-year look ahead, and we sort of build in what are the costs of refurbishment within that programme. So yes.
Yeah, I was just going to invite Simon just from, he's done a lot of modelling on the finance side in respect of levelised costs of electricity, and through the phasing over 25 years or the life of the assets, to answer your question, further down the line there are replacements or extra maintenance costs and things like that. They're kind of included in the in those models. Yeah.
And the reason I was asking the question is very much on the lines of, you might want something new and we're going to invest in the new thing, and we might get rid of the old thing, that's fine, but actually you still need to invest
indeed
in keeping this thing going. Or if you decide to have the two things, and we've talked, it all needs maintain. Thank you.
It's a point very well made. Yeah, thank absolutely you. Thank you.
So could someone explain to me how you manage, your fleet, and is there anything you are doing in that space that actually can either bring efficiencies or, long-term plans for your fleet?
We have a fleet of around 200 vehicles, around 60 of them are what we would term heavy vehicles. Trucks and variations on trucks. We have a highly mobile workforce. A lot of the people we employ, we would deem as frontline workers. We obviously have electricity networks, we have water networks, we have gas networks, we have wastewater networks and sub-networks, and in order for people to maintain them, work on them, operate them, they have to be able to get out and about. We obviously have a fault response requirement, we often, I would say, buy dual purpose vehicles. So most of the time a vehicle will just be driving along roads, going backwards and forwards between places, but we need vehicles which can operate in adverse weather conditions, for the sake of argument. So we're often buying for certain uses vehicles which can respond in those situations, but 90% of the time they don't need those capabilities. But there's no point buying a bunch of panel vans and then when it snows they can't move. Historically we've worked closely with the DOI, so most of our procurement goes through the DOI under their purchasing arrangements. From a maintenance perspective, more recently we've moved away from the DOI, and our maintenance is now split across three private organisations, largely based on vehicle type. As an electricity provider, needless to say, we're keen on electrifying the fleet. We have some electric vehicles, but we've struggled with a lot of our vehicles in terms of what is out there on the market, which we can get. So things like four-wheel drive vehicles, There's not cost-effective electric solutions for the types of vehicles we're often buying, so able to pull 3.5 tons. Our heavy vehicles, there's not cost-effective electric solutions for them at the moment. And probably the final thing I was going to say was different vehicles have different life expectancies. So trucks we might expect to get 10 years out of them. Some of our more specialist heavy vehicles we might be expecting to get 15, 16 years out of them. Smaller vans we might be expecting to get between 5 and 7 years. So
can I add something?
Yeah.
So I mean, because of the size of our fleet, we actually need a skilled person to operate and manage the fleet. It's something that we need to have is an operator license, called an O license. So it also within that license requires us to keep our larger vehicles in effectively depots overnight. And but it's something that's a new requirement, really, that you've got to have somebody skilled in the management of your fleet, and we do.
So going from individual vehicles or small vehicles, now something a lot bigger, what is the life expectancy of the existing interconnector?
Again, multifaceted answer. I'm sort of thinking that when the interconnector was first commissioned, it had a commercial sort of financial life of about 40 years. We've been extremely careful in the use of that asset, and because of that, it's not been overheated or anything like that. So I would envisage that the cable itself would have a life of at least 60 years. Some of the substation assets may need to be replaced, and in fact, our substation at over near Blackpool, a place called Bissum, has just gone through a midlife overhaul. So I've got no qualms about saying that it will definitely meet its initial commercial life, but definitely go beyond it.
Sorry, just quickly going back to the vehicle fleet. So 2 years ago, am I correct in that DOI were the maintenance partner for the fleet, and now that's changed?
Yes, it's changed more recently than 2 years ago.
Right, okay. And particular reason for that? Because, I mean, wasn't the idea behind the DOI centralising some of these services, so there'd be some efficiencies there?
Yeah, I think we struggle to see the efficiencies in terms of realising them. So I think in terms of the proposal was valid. I think there's been a number of challenges on the island, and so in an ideal world it was the right thing to do. I think in reality it's not worked out as well as was intended. One particular issue coming to mind is I think the DOI have struggled to find qualified mechanics to help provide the service, and as a consequence of that, the service that we then got from the DOI was not where we wanted it to be, and I think it's probably fair to say not where the DOI wanted it to be. And we've probably spent the last two and a half years talking with the DOI about some of the issues we'd been experiencing, what we could do to help them as much as to help us. And I think it ultimately got to a place where they wanted to focus on their own fleet, and we probably wanted to have a little bit more leeway around ours. From a financial perspective, one of the challenges is always if you do something a different way, maybe you can save a bit of money. If we have a team of four people reliant on a certain specialist vehicle, and that specialist vehicle isn't then available because whatever the reason it's not available, often the cost to us of not having that available for a team of four people for a day is significantly higher than maybe the a cost saving on a part or on a procurement approach.
Just very briefly. The other part then, which you mentioned, so I've got to pick up on you, is the O-licence. So do you think the requirements and the processes you have to work through with as being an O-licence operator are okay, or is that something else that DOI should worry about in the future?
We have particular problems with it. So you're probably aware there's two levels of licensing. There's what's called VO license, and then there's the operator registration.
Mm-hmm.
And from my understanding, somebody like the DOI will have an operator registration, not an operator license. And we have to have an operator license because in things like storm conditions, we will often send teams away to help out the UK, help out Ireland. And in order for our vehicles to drive on their roads, we have to have the operator license. But that might apply to 10 of our heavy vehicles. The other 50 of our heavy vehicles, the same requirements fall on them, even though they're not going away and will never do so. And then there's nuances within that, within the regulations and within best practice. So for the sake of argument, there is a best practice that a single transport manager is responsible for 50 vehicles. We have some leeway around that, but we're trying to manage our heavy fleet within 60 purely because of that, because of the O-licensing requirements. If we could split our fleet between O-license and operator registration, that would make our lives easier, and it's something we're talking to RTLC about. But at times it feels like it's a structure which works somewhere else, which has been applied here, and then maybe doesn't fully reflect.
Was there ever the possibility, did you discuss with the possibility with DOI of having, you know, a Bolton style or a Bury style big building where all of these vehicles are done in one place rather than in a refurbished buildings in Ellerslie or something like that, and then the O-licence? Did you talk about, you know, using economies of scales and working together with them? Did that ever happen, or was it just by chance?
We've talked about it. If you sort of say about having all of the vehicles in one place, we don't want all of the vehicles in one place. We want people who live in the south to have a vehicle in the south.
Okay.
We want people who live in the north to have access to a vehicle in the north. So we don't want one of our vehicles parked in every corner, but we do want the vehicles sort of distributed across the island.
Could someone explain how domestic and business customers can benefit from selling back surplus self-generated electricity to the MUA, and then in that answer also what impact does that have on the operational finances or even the operations of the MUA?
At the moment we've got about 1,000 customers who have got their own renewable energy installed. That's ever increasing. It's reported to the board, and it's something we're very mindful of. But at the moment, in terms of self-generation on the island, if you do it as a collective, it probably represents about 7 megawatts. It's fairly significant, and it's growing. So we need to be mindful of how that interfaces with the grid and the impacts on the grid and the impacts on the financial pricing strategy as well. So we've got two sustainable generation tariffs, one for domestic and one for businesses, and they are being used.
Reflecting back on the existing interconnector, there has been talk of the requirement for a new interconnector. Is that now a settled part of plans going forward? And if so, what kind of what's the expected cost of that that connector likely to be?
So basically, this plan is evolving. As we said before, we're trying to optimise the amount of upfront investment. There are alternatives. So in the old day, pre-crisis days, all the assumptions that were made, all the modelling that was done, all the reports that were published, everything was all about a second interconnector, so you're quite right. In the changed world, I think the expectation of that interconnector at the time was probably circa £100 million. With what's happened since the energy crisis, with interest rates, with supply chain problems, you could probably double that. So we have, in terms of optimization, You've also got an opportunity potentially to interface with an offshore wind farm. So is it worth, that won't happen by 2030, but is it worth waiting for to see what emerges there? And there are other more economic options anyway. So it's still being looked at. We're still doing feasibility work on it. But it's probably not the front runner. It's still in the basket of options that we're looking at. It's still there. It doesn't look like it's the front runner at the moment.
That was Tynwald's Environment and Infrastructure Committee evidence session with officers from the MUA. So what do you think? Are you surprised that the MUA is still waiting to find out what government expects future electricity needs to be? Has the government's shared fleet services failed? Are we any closer to understanding how our electricity will be generated in the future? I'm Phil Gorn, Goramayus and Geisterkrom. Thanks for listening.